Welcome to CoreCast, a production of National Community Renaissance, a nonprofit affordable housing developer dedicated to solving the housing challenges facing seniors, veterans, and low-income families in America. CoreCast is designed to expand interest in the area of affordable housing, as well as interview problem solvers and explore solutions to our housing challenges. And welcome into the National Core Studios for the latest edition of CoreCast. I'm your host, as always, Jonathan Kendrick, joined by National Core's President and CEO, Steve Pontell. Steve, thanks for being here today. How are you?
Certainly, Jonathan. I'm doing fine. Thank you.
And we have a very good show today for the audience. We're going to be joined a little bit later by Rick Cole, the current city manager of Santa Monica, and a person with a lot of experience in local government, and should be a really interesting discussion about the local government's response and responsibility in providing housing. And Steve will get into that with City Manager Rick Cole a little bit later. We also have, as always, the Novogratz tax credit update on the latest in affordable housing, the legislative happenings and goings on there. But first, we start, as we always do, with our water cooler segment, and really a lot has been going on in affordable housing, a lot of ideas thrown out recently, both here locally in California, in the United States, and all over the world, and we're going to get into a few of those ideas, some of them very innovative, as governments, the media, many folks starting to really realize housing and its importance and the crisis that many areas, including California, are in with a lack of housing. And we'll start right there with California. Governor Jerry Brown recently released his revise to the budget, which was passed recently. This portion that we're going to talk about is still being discussed in the California legislature. It's this idea called a by-right housing proposal. The governor has started to realize as well that there is a shortage of housing. His state treasurer puts the number at about 1.5 million housing units that the state is short currently. And he's come up with an innovative proposal recently that has polarized quite a few folks. But it is a step forward, I think, and just that it's raised the discussion. And the idea is that developers will be able to get their projects approved by city staff in an expedited time frame if it includes a certain amount of affordable housing. 20% of the housing is affordable. It can be 10% if it's located on a transit stop. But it gets to bypass some of the review, including the CEQA process. And so, Steve, this is something that you have looked at, and general thoughts, reaction to the governor's proposal.
Sure, Jonathan, thank you. So I have a heavy predisposition towards local control and believe that local government is the best place to have a conversation and to be able to make decisions. Unfortunately, if local government's not doing their job, there are things that need to be approached regionally or at a higher level. And you can see it across the board in critical infrastructure. You know, every city does not manage its own water. They're part of larger systems, transportation systems are regional, because we have a rich history of local government sometimes not being willing to work in a cooperative way with surrounding communities. For example, you know, the city of Diamond Bar at one point put a gate across Grand Avenue so people from Chino Hills couldn't drive through Diamond Bar. So obviously those kinds of challenges exist, and when that happens, it's important to have a more regional approach. And this is an example of that, where unfortunately for the last 40 years, 50 years, local government has not been doing the job, allowing housing to be developed at a price point that people can afford. And this is an example where the state is stepping in and saying that if developers develop a certain product geared towards people that need to be able to afford it, they will then have the right to be able to develop it and will not be able to be stopped through what is unfortunately often an arbitrary use of regulations in order to stop development. And so in this particular incident, because local government has not been doing their job, the state is stepping in to say, okay, we have a crisis. You know, I think the largest crisis facing the state of California is the housing crisis. And this could be one of the tools to help move that challenge a little bit.
And there's a couple groups that have come out strongly against this plan. One of them, the League of California Cities, for that point that you very much mentioned right now, that the local governance, the local control aspect. But a couple others, the labor unions and environmentalists are also coming out as opponents of this. And in large part, it's due to the CEQA Act, the California Environmental Quality Act, that's going to get a bit of a streamlined approach here. And this is one that often causes a lot of uncertainty as it relates to development. And it's obviously one that the legislature recognizes as causing delays because they bypassed CEQA and a couple other projects in the Sacramento Kings arena. And then recently we learned in the last week or so in the Capitol building is going to undergo some renovations in Sacramento, and the legislature approved a CEQA exemption for that because they realized when their project is on the line, we need to get this through. But there are groups that go up against that a little bit. You've talked about in the past, Steve, that the intent of the law is a good one, but sometimes it can be misused. How is that happening right now?
Sure, and it's unfortunate because everybody in California wants to protect the California environment. That's a given. The question is when the laws to protect the environment are used for other purposes, and it's known widely as the abuse of CEQA as opposed to the use of CEQA. And the two groups you mentioned, labor has been very effective in using CEQA to stop projects that they don't want or to try and force a project labor agreement. So if labor wants a particular project, whether it be a development to be built with labor construction workers or whether or not it's a business that they want to have unionized, they'll use CEQA to stop it. And then the environmental community will often use CEQA to stop projects that they don't like. And at the end of the day, it's unfortunate because even if you mitigate projects, even if you meet clear standards, you can fully expect to be sued under CEQA more often than not. And the consequence of that has been a significant constraint on the supply of housing, and that artificially increases the cost of housing. And for some reason, people think that if we don't build housing, people won't come. Well, since the vast majority of our population growth is births over deaths, we as a society have a responsibility to adequately house our own children, as an example. And at the end of the day, this by-right development that the government's pushing is one small step in that direction.
A couple other stories recently in the news that National Corps has actually been involved in the discussion here for a while under development on a property that's going to house formerly homeless veterans, and it's a big push across California and other jurisdictions as well. Los Angeles saying that it's come out with a deal to turn 500 apartments or 500 motel units into apartments for homeless veterans. But the idea that really it's a supply issue. There are vouchers for many of these homeless veterans that will pay for the rent, and folks have these vouchers and they're still homeless now because there's just not enough places for them to live. I know, Steve, this is an issue that you're deeply involved in and passionate about. What needs to happen there in Los Angeles and in California and the nation as a whole for us to get these homeless veterans housed? And it goes beyond that as well. There's a big focus on veterans now, but also homeless families and seniors as well.
Sure, the chronically homeless. Ultimately, this is not complicated. The way you solve homelessness is you provide a home. At the end of the day, that's the only solution for homelessness. And unfortunately, there are so many distortions in the market, primarily on the supply side, that the production of an adequate supply of housing for people that are formerly homeless of a type and style and a quality that would be appropriate is very difficult to produce. And one of the challenges we have is almost every city has what they would call, quote unquote, a nuisance motel. And unfortunately, a lot of marginally housed people are living in these hotels that are not up to code, not up to standard, are avoiding taxes on both sides, whether they be TOT taxes or avoiding the rules of being an apartment complex. And people are bringing in, heating pads for cooking or Bunsen burners and violating all sorts of codes and regulations. The opportunity that exists if cities really want to go after these kinds of motels that are not operating according to code, They can bring pressure to bear that makes the current business model not economically viable and allow those motels to be converted into something that can be transitional housing for homeless or even permanent supportive housing for different populations that are going to need help. And the veterans are the current hot need because there are so many thousands of them. And I think the population as a whole recognize, once again, we as a society have a responsibility for people that have served all of us through a service in the military should have a housing option. And we're hoping some of the programs underway, the one you talked about in the city of LA is an example where the city of Los Angeles Housing Authority changed the rules in order to make it more attractive for developers to go in, acquire motels, and then convert them into a very quality place to live for somebody who's currently living on the streets.
And motel conversions is one innovative way to provide these housing units. And Steve, I know this is something that you give a lot of thought to. What are some of the other innovative kind of ideas that you've come across that people are trying to implement? And it may, you know, and it will take some regulatory change as well for governments to catch up with some of the work that the private sector and others are the thinking they're doing about how we can provide shelter. What are some of those innovative options that local governments and larger jurisdictions can look at?
Sure. Well, I mean, at the end of the day, it's basic math. We know how much money people make. We know what it costs to rent an apartment or buy a condo or have a house or live in a place. And we know what the costs of production are. We know what the cost of land is, cost of construction. We know what the cost of the additional design requirements and development code issues and fees and everything else that go into a development. So we can see what the revenue is. We can see what the cost is. And those jurisdictions that are willing to do the math, all they have to do is do the math in order to say, okay, where can we cut back in order to allow the market to produce housing that the market can afford. And so some of the opportunities local government has is around land use, density, development code issues, and being able to say in this area, in this zone, we're going to create, for example, a housing enterprise zone. The rules are just going to be different. What you can do with materials, what you can do with design and aesthetics, what you can do with amenities, all of that is going to be different in order to try and drive down the cost. And historically, we've always had a range of housing alternatives. And so you have a mobile home park on one end. And so maybe it's time to reinvent the mobile home park. Maybe there are manufactured housing solutions where it's a mobile home park, you know, filled with Airstream modular units that would be, you know, attractive to millennials and designed in a way that's creative and innovative and interesting. And then maybe there are various move-up options. Maybe there are different material alternatives. There are different places in Phoenix. They just opened a new container community using shipping containers as the structural elements for construction. You know, maybe there are different housing configurations as far as what should be private and what should be communal. Maybe there should be communal living spaces and kitchens where there are individual sleeping areas. And so it's just a matter of we as a society thinking outside of the box. And all of this does not require subsidy. A lot of it just says if we change the rules, then the market will be able to produce something that people can afford. And those cities that get creative about this will be able to adequately house the people that work in their cities and be able to adequately house their children. And those cities that don't will not be able to sustain their economy, and the children that grow up there will not be able to live there. And so from my perspective, it's a pretty easy conversation between responsible leaders and irresponsible leaders.
And just to prove the point that not all new innovative ideas are necessarily good ideas, I came across one this week, a story from the town of St. Ives in Cornwall in Britain, where they passed a referendum last month. 80 citizens voted in favor of a plan that would require new housing projects to be reserved for full-time residents of the town, essentially banning foreigners or people looking for a second home to live in that city. And now it's been picked up by the new mayor of London, who's starting to come on board and perhaps advocate for this idea in London as well. Why, Steve, is an idea like that, you know, maybe not going to solve the problem or create other problems that are unforeseen?
Well, unfortunately, people are being driven by fear and self-interest more than they are about good community development and thoughtfulness about the future of their communities. And so the challenge that we have is if we're going to have a free market system, and if we're going to have property rights, and if we're going to have the ability of people to own and manage and dispose of their property, with that comes a certain amount of you know, choice that individuals are going to be able to have. And so you take, for example, Airbnb. I mean, what Airbnb has done is unleash a huge capacity of underutilized space that people have had in their homes and make it available for people that are traveling in different places. And so you can try and ban it, but it would be much better to think about logical health and safety regulations in order for people to be able to use something that they own, to be able to market in a way that is mutually beneficial for them, their community. And so understanding that kind of a dynamic and how much surplus capacity we have that is underutilized and how can we unlock that surplus capacity is really important. And at the other end of the spectrum, just the whole issue, unfortunately, seems to be a growing representation about building walls and banning immigrants. Foreign ownership in the United States is extraordinarily high. And there's a lot of people from London that own properties in coastal California, mountain California, et cetera. I don't think they'd want to start a game that says, wait a minute, somebody from LA cannot own a flat in London. If we were to turn around and say, somebody in London cannot own property in California. And so at the end of the day, coming up with these kinds of barriers does nothing to build communities and solve the problem.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Thank you, Steve, for this portion of the program. We're going to transition now to our time with City Manager Rick Cole, who we're very honored will join us today on the program. Currently, the City Manager of Santa Monica, where he's responsible for the day-to-day administration of that city, a budget of $564 million he oversees there. Previously, he was the Deputy Mayor for Budget and Innovation for the City of Los Angeles. It's a great title. For 15 years before that, he was the City Manager for Ventura and Azusa. He's won national awards for municipal management excellence and urban planning leadership. He was also served 12 years on the Pasadena City Council, and he was mayor when Pasadena adopted its landmark general plan, which was an early model for what is known as smart growth. He is called one of Southern California's most visionary planning thinkers by the Los Angeles Times, and we're honored to have Rick Cole with us here on CoreCast.
Our goal today is just have a casual conversation, primarily about housing. But before we get there, how is the Santa Monica experience going for you?
Steve, it's been nearly a year that I've been city manager in Santa Monica. It's a remarkable place. I often refer to it as the most complicated 8.3 square miles in Southern California. It's a challenging job. We're a city with very high aspirations. One of the most significant challenges has been that we take on a lot. I joked with the city council half seriously that their problem was that they had 15 top three priorities. So we were able to focus in on what truly are the transformative strategic goals that could move the city forward. And the council came together after listening to the community on five key strategic goals that are really informing much of our work. The first is mobility. We're excited about Expo having been completed. We are now part of the regional rail network in LA County that's now over 100 miles in length and increasingly connecting up our disparate and spread out county. Two, affordability. One of the things that distinguishes Santa Monica is while we're a very fortunate community and property values are very high, we've always been committed to having opportunities for affordable housing and having opportunities for people from all different walks of life be able to live in a very desirable community. The third is our airport. We have a big airport designed for biplanes that now is a base for private and corporate jets. We've really outgrown the airport, and it's time to think about repurposing that 227 acres for a better use in the future. Fourth one is homelessness. Santa Monica is obviously a place that's long been a magnet for folks who appreciate our weather and who are looking for a less harsh place for the very tough life of being out on the streets. We've done a great job over the years in dealing with that disproportionate impact, but we recognize that we really have to be a much more active part of the regional solutions to homelessness. So we're working very closely with the county and the city of LA. And the final one is something around well-being in our community. We call it Learn and Thrive. It involves our social services, our library. It's really to emphasize lifelong learning in our increasingly sophisticated global economy. People have to be ready to continue to sharpen their skills, and the better we prepare our kids for that future, and the sooner we do that, the better it is for everyone. And we want to make sure that people are not just economically thriving, but are having the opportunity to thrive socially and in terms of their health in every other way. So those are our big five. We're working on lots of other things, but those are the big five, and it's really great to be embarked upon a 3 to 5 year journey towards some what we think are transformative goals.
Very good. Well, maybe that's a great segue to maybe drill into the affordability one and the homeless one. You know, obviously one of the biggest challenges facing Southern California, California as a whole, is how do we house the people that are here today? And Santa Monica is a great, you know, microcosm of the problem writ large. What are some of the things that you're thinking about as ways to be able to, you know, move the bar and have an adequate supply of housing for the people that need it?
Well, that's a big challenge because, again, we're 8.3 square miles surrounded by a city that is 400 square miles, the city of Los Angeles. And, of course, we're only two of the 88 cities in L.A. County, and L.A. is one of six counties in a region that largely blends together from Camp Pendleton up to Ventura, and from Ventura out over the hills to Lancaster and Palmdale, and of course out into the whole Inland Empire. So there's no way that we're going to solve the regional housing crisis in 8.3 square miles. We recognize, I think more than most cities, our responsibility to do our fair share. And sometimes we actually get criticized for doing more than our fair share. And that's not just in terms of the number of new housing units that we build or the vigilance that we have to keep the ones we have affordable, but also as we build new affordable units, over the last 20 years, fully 40% of the new housing built in Santa Monica is affordable housing. That is, it has covenants that restrict the income levels of who can live there. We have transitional housing for folks and families that have been homeless. We have very low income housing. We have low income housing and some moderate. We have not done as good a job on moderate income and so-called workforce housing, and so we're increasingly concerned about what's sometimes called the barbell economy, where it's literally difficult. You know, we've done a really good job, by no means solved the problem, but done a really good job of trying to protect people at the low end of the income spectrum. And people at the high end are, of course, bidding up both rental and home ownership prices, which is increasingly crowding out working families and the middle class. So that's a real challenge. One of the things we're doing now is we're considering a ballot measure for November that will focus not on the building of new housing, as important as that is, as the preservation of existing affordable housing. And there are two dimensions to that. One is the acquisition of privately owned housing to ensure that it remains affordable in perpetuity. And secondly, the rehabilitation of privately owned housing, because a lot of our rental housing stock in Santa Monica is 40, 50, 60, 70 years old, and that requires reinvestment, and landlords are reluctant to reinvest in rent-controlled units. So there's an opportunity to enhance the preservation of affordable housing. Now, on the production side of both market rate and affordable housing, the voters in Santa Monica and the city councils in Santa Monica have focused a new housing development, not in our existing long settled neighborhoods, but more in our downtown and along transit corridors and near the new three stops on the Expo Line. So council just approved twin projects, one for about 260 market rate units that will go into our downtown, and just a block or two away, projects that meets their affordable housing requirements is being developed by the Community Corporation of Santa Monica for about 62 units of affordable housing. We typically look to mix those on site, but these are separated only by a couple of blocks, and it allowed us to support Community Corporation of Santa Monica to do really quite a unique affordable housing project that will provide some additional services to the folks, the families who live there. So we're doing a lot of imaginative and creative and tenacious things, but in the face of a regional housing crisis, it is really difficult to make headway.
So, yeah, completely understanding the regional nature of it, any thought about what kind of supply Santa Monica would need to produce just to meet its area's demands?
You know, that's a difficult question, because what we literally face is, because Santa Monica's, the quality of our schools, the quality of our parks, the quality of the way we've maintained our infrastructure, and the attractiveness of the private investment, you know, it's a community with lots of public and private amenities. And so who wouldn't want to live in Santa Monica is sometimes the question. And obviously we can't solve the problem of everybody who would like to live in an attractive beachside community supplying enough housing. So part of our focus is simply to ensure that we have a balanced community, that we have opportunities for seniors, disabled, formerly homeless people at one end of the economic spectrum, but also, again, focusing on this middle area, the folks who work in our stores, in our offices, in our hotels, in our restaurants. Not that every single person who works in those businesses would be able to afford to live in Santa Monica, but that we continue to have a place for a wide range of income levels in the city. That's our focus, and I don't think we could build our way to that solution. We have to continue to expand the supply of housing where it's appropriate, but also protect the affordability of existing and make sure that we include in new housing different layers of income affordability.
Well, and you make a great point about some working hard to meet their quote-unquote fair share. Other cities may not be working quite so hard. And I don't know if you've had a chance to hear much or look much into the governor's new initiative about buy right development. Have you had a chance to look at that at all?
We have. We're quite sensitive to the balance between local control and achieving statewide equity. It's actually our assembly member, Richard Bloom, former council member and mayor from Santa Monica, who's carrying legislation on behalf of the governor. So we've been in close touch with assembly member Bloom. We've expressed some concerns about unintended consequences for a city like us who's committed to doing our fair share. But where the league has urged us to come out in opposition, we have stood aside from that. We've expressed our concern, but we endorse the principle that the state has an interest in making sure that when cities exercise local control, they're not exercising the right to exclude a mix of incomes in their community.
Right. Now, it's going to be a very interesting discussion, you know, also being a big fan of local control, but the challenge opens the door for those places, those municipalities that are not taking local responsibility. So I think it is going to be a very interesting.
I like that vocabulary, Steve. I think that emphasizing that with control comes responsibility. I mean, that's really the argument for local control, is that communities are different and there shouldn't be a one-size solution. But that does not exempt anybody from having their share of responsibility for coming up with their own solution. In other words, you might want to fine-tune how you contribute to housing Southern Californians, but you can't opt out of doing something. And too often, local control has been defined by some cities as, we have the right to do what we want, or more importantly, we have the right to not do our fair share. And that's just wrong. It's typical of the kind of predatory behavior that makes no sense whatever in a region like ours that's so interconnected. Look, there's no Torrance economy. There's no Santa Monica economy. There's no Beverly Hills airspace. There's no Gardena watershed. The traffic and streets and highways can't stop at a city border. So if our education, you know, if our community colleges and state colleges, our whole economy, if our transportation system connects us up, if people work in one city, shop in another city, go to school and take classes at a community college in a third city, we then have to recognize that issues like water, homelessness, housing our workforce, those are shared responsibilities. How each community shoulders its responsibilities, I think that's something that's better done by the elected leaders of local communities than by some faceless regional agency. But if cities fail to do the right thing, then the only alternative is faceless regional agencies, and I think we don't want to go there, so it's up to each community to show its good faith.
All right. So what do you think, I mean, you know, depending on the analysis, it was probably, you know, the 1960s was the last time Southern California adequately housed the people that live in Southern California. What comes to mind is the reasons why that we've ended up with such a supply shortage for the people that are living here today, our own children?
Well, I think there's a number of factors, and I don't know that I have any particularly profound insight beyond what anybody who is paying attention, and particularly much less than some of the academic experts have found through their research. But let me cite three things that just make, you know, that are common sense challenges. One is we clung to a zoning regime that is unique to a particular time in history and is increasingly shown to be counterproductive. Zoning is actually a really new innovation in how cities work. It's really a product of less than 100 years out of the 5,000 years that people have been building cities around the world. In the last 100 years, Americans pioneered this idea of segregating where people live, where people work, and institutional uses. And it seemed like a great idea when you had a steel mill next to people trying to raise their children. So it totally makes sense to try to protect the quiet and safety of residential neighborhoods from obnoxious commercial uses that intrude into the daily life. But that gets to an absurdity. So, you have a FedEx office, which, the noisiest thing that happens there is the Xerox machine, right? Well, in the zoning code, that might be classified as a printing plant, right? Which is in the same category as an old-fashioned, thing that sounds like a freight train coming through, printing, a million copies of the LA Times for tomorrow's paper. By segregating compatible uses, we've generated this tremendous problem of sprawl, this tremendous problem of transportation discontinuity, and having to spend billions of dollars to make the problem hardly any better or sometimes worse. So that's one thing, is that there's no reason why we couldn't build above commercial, but it was illegal in California for years. And then when it finally began to be reintroduced, it was viewed as some kind of exotic thing that they called mixed use. Well, for 4,900 of the 5,000 years that people have been building cities, segregating uses was the exception, not the rule. And we're finally beginning to recover a sense that there are some commercial uses, low-level neighborhood-serving community uses, and workspaces that make sense. And we shouldn't have a one-story, retail when we could have used that on a transportation corridor to have a two or three or four or five, or sometimes in more urban settings, even six or seven-story opportunity. So Santa Monica was one of the pioneers when we brought back the Third Street Promenade 30 years ago. The one piece of new construction there was the Jans Court. Hardly anyone going down the Third Street Promenade even notices today, but it's a six-story building, brand new, built in the early 80s, fits into the historic architecture there, designed in a way that steps back the fourth and fifth and sixth stories. It's a very well-designed, very nicely fitting building, and it provides housing that would not be there under the old way of doing business. So that's, I think, one of the big drivers. A second big driver is the California Environmental Quality Act, which was passed under Ronald Reagan at a time of tremendous, right after Earth Day, right after the Clean Water Act at the national level, the Environmental Protection Agency, Endangered Species Act. We passed our own law to protect California's extraordinary natural resources, our ocean, Yosemite, the Sierras, our deserts. And now it's used by one developer to keep another, developer from building competition. It's used by interest groups to shake down people that they like. It's used to tie up sensible projects where you're building basically what was built across the street. You want to build now on the other side of the street, and people want to have a full-scale environmental impact report and then sue you over it because it's, quote, inadequate. So that's the CEQA is a great law. The misuse of CEQA is part of the reason why we're in a housing crisis. Those are two big factors. There are many more. There's no single answer to why we have failed to invest in housing. And there's a third factor that, you know, is just a reality. Household sizes have decreased. So we need more housing even when we don't have more people, because a population that's aging and living longer, a population having fewer children, population of more singles, you know, means that we simply need more housing units. And yet we've assumed that, well, okay, now we have twice as many households, so now we need twice as many four-bedroom suburban homes on 20,000 square foot lots. Well, that's not what a retiree, single widow needs to have built for her. That's not what a young couple who are postponing having children need when they first buy their first home. It's not necessarily what empty nesters need when they retire. So we've failed to keep up with the demography of California as well.
Right, and if you look at you know, things like how local government is financed, and you know why we have two times the amount of retail while we have a shortage of housing, it's not. I mean, local government plays the cards they're dealt. And if they're dealt the card that says retail has a higher value proposition, then they're going to do what they can do to incent that. And if they view housing as a cost, they're going to do what they can do to de-incent that. And so, yeah, I mean, there are those factors at work that are not overly complicated, but they just have huge long-time ripple effects.
Well, Steve, I am turning 63 next month. And the year I graduated from college, the summer of 1978, we had a genuine crisis in California. We had, because of a run-up in housing prices, a lot of people whose taxes were automatically escalating, even though their incomes were not. And the reason they were automatically escalating is they were pegged to what other people were paying when they were buying and selling. And so that was a real crisis for people on fixed incomes and for middle-income families. They were seeing their taxes rise way faster than their incomes. And we also had a big surplus in Sacramento. So people, despite the prophets of doom who said the sky will fall, they said, well, you know, we're going to vote to fix this. We're going to pass Proposition 13. And there was an emergency response. It passed, and the sky didn't fall. The state used its temporary windfall to bail out city and county governments, and we made it through that crisis. That was when I had just graduated from college. Well, I'm now going to turn 63. We have never gone back and taken a look and said, okay, that crisis is over. We now have a different way of figuring property tax. How are we going to finance city and county governments that make sense, that's sustainable, that's equitable, that isn't a Rube Goldberg contraption of, I build a shopping mall on my border and dump half of the traffic into your town, and I get 100% of the revenue. Those kind of things are all unintended consequences of a response to a crisis from 40 years ago. And we have not really faced up to the reality that city and county governments are going to need to provide police services. They're going to need to provide fire and emergency medical service. They're going to need to provide adequate parks. We're going to have a planning department in cities to regulate private development. Those are things that aren't like today or tomorrow or next month. Those are going to be with us for a long time. But our tax system is not designed for the long haul. In fact, it's not designed at all. It is we've backed into it as a result of a response to a long, long gone crisis. And no one in Sacramento has been willing to say, okay, since Proposition 13 passed, now what? And that doesn't even mean undoing Prop 13. It just means undoing what ended up being the jury-rigged alternative to financing city and county governments in the wake of Prop 13. That is something that has, as you say, I watch city governments systematically disadvantage job-creating businesses that would put their people in good, well-paying, long-term jobs in favor of building a car dealership, which provides handful of jobs on huge swaths of asphalt, and which can then pack up and move tomorrow to go across the street if a different city offers them a better deal, and that's just crazy. But it persists because of this failure to tackle. And as you say, as well, we got way too many numbers, especially in the time of Amazon and internet sales, and far too few housing units. A lot of that does, as you say, go to the fact that city governments make money when they open stores, as long as the stores get full, and they lose money if they actually have people that they have to provide police and park services for. That's a crazy disincentive for doing government right.
Right. And I think, you know, the opportunity that is ahead is the crisis will get to the point where we can no longer ignore it. And unfortunately, overcrowding in housing is often a hidden cost on the families that are suffering most that can least afford it, that society doesn't see for a long time. But once it starts seeing it, then hopefully our local government leaders, because I do believe local government has the tools to solve this. You know, we can't count on, you know, D.C., we can't count on Sacramento. We do have the ability to solve the housing shortage. It's just a matter of having the will to put it forward. And I do very much appreciate what you've been doing to be able to lead and instigate this conversation. It would be my hope that other cities would be equally willing to figure out their role in a regional solution.
Well, I agree with you on both fronts, Steve. That is both an opportunity and a responsibility for local communities to take the lead, and that it's a conversation, right? In America, in a democracy, in California, we are not going to stuff anything down people's throats, nor should we try. We need to be talking to our communities about intelligent, long-term, sensible solutions to our common challenges. Most Californians care deeply about the future. Most Californians care deeply about where their children and grandchildren are going to live, and we have to have a conversation about how to create a better future, and it's not a traffic-choked, unaffordable metropolis. It's about creating better quality of life and better standard of living for ourselves and those that come after us.
Absolutely. And so I very much appreciate you taking some time and look forward to continuing the conversation.
Great talking with you, Steve, and thank you for all the work that you do.
Absolutely. Thanks, Rick.
And again, a big thank you to Rick Cole for his time and sitting down with us for this episode of CoreCast. Really a great interview there with Steve, and we appreciate the input and the thoughtfulness there and for his work with the City of Santa Monica. Next up, we have our tax credit update. Michael Novogradic provides it for us each month, a summary of what he discusses on his Tax Credit Tuesday podcast. Stay tuned for that update and our wrap-up here on CoreCast.
Hello, I'm Michael Novogradic, managing partner of Novogradic & Company, LLP. We're a national CPA firm specializing in tax audit and consulting services for tax credit assisted developments, especially multifamily affordable housing. I'm here today to share with you some affordable housing news highlights that were featured over the past month in my weekly Tax Credit Tuesday podcast. If you're ready, let's get started. In affordable housing news, we have a very exciting development to discuss. The long-awaited Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act of 2016 was introduced in May by Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell, along with the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, Republican Orrin Hatch. The bill, called S-2962, includes a proposal to increase the low-income housing tax credit by 50%. That's 50% over 5 years, starting in 2017, so 10% a year. Now, Cantwell originally announced her intention to introduce the bill at a Seattle press event in March. Cantwell, a Democrat from Washington, and Hatch, a Republican from Utah, were joined by two other colleagues as original co-sponsors. The two other colleagues were the top Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee, Ron Wyden of Oregon, and the likely incoming Senate Democratic leader, Charles Schumer of New York. It bears noting that it is highly unusual for the Finance Committee chairman to co-sponsor a tax bill sponsored by the minority party, not to mention to be joined in support by the ranking member on the committee and a member of the Senate leadership. The fact that Cantwell was able to secure the support of Senator Hatch is remarkable, and it's a testament to her effectiveness in rallying support for using the low-income housing tax credit to help battle the lack of affordable housing in America. The headline provision is a 50% increase in per capita tax credit authority that would take place gradually over 5 years. More specifically, as I noted, it would increase the per capita and small state minimum allocations by 10% each for 5 years. In addition to that, though, the legislation also features several other provisions. The bill would set a minimum 4% credit rate for acquisition and for tax-exempt bond finance properties. The 4% minimum would be similar to the 9% floor that was set by the PATH Act at the end of last year. This 4% minimum rate for tax-exempt bond financed properties translates into roughly 25% more equity. This would make more tax-exempt bond projects financially feasible. Now, the bill would also allow income averaging in low-income housing tax credit developments. That would allow units for households earning up to 80% of their median income to qualify as long as the average income limit in the property was 60% or less of the area median income. A provision like this would be particularly helpful in high housing cost markets and sparsely populated low-income communities and low-income community revitalization efforts. If approved, the bill would be one of the biggest changes in the 30-year history of the low-income housing tax credit. The last change of this magnitude was the Community Renewal Tax Relief Act of 2000. As you may recall, that bill increased the per capita cap by 40% over 2 years and created an annual inflation adjustment. The Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008, by the way, had a temporary 10% increase for 2008 and 2009. Also, Senators Cantwell and Hatch are working on a second bill that would include provisions that were announced in Cantwell's proposal in March, but were not included in the Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act. Likely to be included in that second bill is a 50% basis boost for units serving extremely low-income households. If you want to read the bill, go to www.taxcredithousing.com. You can also check out my Notes from the Democratic blog for further updates and analysis of the Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act of 2016. Well, that brings me to the end of this report. For more tax credit news, tune in to our weekly Tax Credit Tuesday podcast. It's available on iTunes and on the Novogratic website. At the Novogratic website, you'll find us at www.novoco.com/podcast. This is Michael Novogratic. Thanks for listening.
Thank you to Michael Novogratic for his tax credit update that he does for us each month. You can catch his podcast, Tax Credit Tuesdays, on novogratic.com. And we're here to wrap it up, as we always do, with what we learned this week. Steve, go ahead and take the first shot.
Sure. I think Rick does a great job articulating, number one, the need and the responsibility the local government has to meet the needs of their community. But in addition to that, you know, I think he did a good job in being able to articulate how much transparency, what a role transparency plays into that. The more you can communicate with residents, the more they understand the need, the more then they would be willing to, you know, come up with creative solutions, as opposed to, you know, trying to come up with solutions and forcing it on them. And so I think a local government that understands their need is able to articulate that in a way their residents can understand it. Is it going to be able to move forward with projects that address that, and especially in the areas of housing? So I appreciate Rick's openness and honesty about, you know, some local governments that have not done the job, but how the opportunities is for those that want to do the job to be successful.
Yeah, and I think I really took away from this podcast episode the idea of innovation and how that can be done in the private sector, but also in government as well, and how the government can come up with new ideas and to work with the private sector, with nonprofits, to cause positive change in communities. And also, you know, the idea of adopting innovations and being able to keep up with what the other sectors are doing as well to move toward those common goals of providing housing for all. Well, that will do it for this edition of CoreCast. Thank you very much, as always, for listening. You can have your say with the show. Please send us your feedback, your questions, your comments. We'll incorporate that in. You can reach us at nationalcore.org. You can email me, jkendrick@nationalcore.org. We'd love to hear from you and get your input and your feedback in the show. It's a dialogue here as we figure out how to solve the housing challenge in California. It's not just going to be the two of us here on this podcast. We need everyone to put our heads together and figure it out. And we're thankful again to our guest, Michael Novogradac, as he always participates, and Rick Cole for his insight and his time as well. Well, that will do it for this edition of CoreCast. We'll catch you back here next month. And remember, together we transform lives and communities.